Welcome to the Protectors Podcast. And as usual, we start talking about the conversation before we hit record. Joined again by my awesome co-host, Am I Dare. And now we are joined by international New York Times and every type of bestseller, Greg Hurwitz. How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing great. Good to be here.
I'm glad to have, you know what? Am and I were just starting the Audible version of Orphan X. And it's quickly turning into one of my favorite Audibles. When I feel immersed into these books and I feel like I'm part of the story right away, I'm hooked. Because I've tried different types of Audibles and stuff. Because whenever I'm on these long road trips, I'm like, I can listen to a book. Mm-hmm. But I'm quickly interested and quickly like consumed by the Orphan X universe now.
Well, thanks, man. I have so my audio reader is called Scott Brick, and you guys both know him. He's one of the best in the business. And what's really funny is before I sold Orphan X, I wrote the manuscript, and there's a number. Orphan X is he was raised by the age of 12 to be an off the books government assassin. And then at some point he left the program and kind of went off the radar, and he's being pursued by the same people who built him. But he does these pro bono missions for people in desperate need. And he has this encrypted number, 1-855 to nowhere. And if you call it, he actually answers the real number. And so before I even sold the manuscript, I went over to Scott's house. Scott had done my last, 6-7 books probably. And I was like, I got a really weird request for you, but we're going out with the book. There's a phone number in it. And I want to make sure if any of the editors we submit to call the number that Orphan X picks up. And I want you to be the voice of Orphan X because he's so great. So we recorded it in his little sound booth before I even did a deal for the series. And he's been the voice of Orphan X ever since.
I love that on so many levels. Not only will I be calling that number, but just the little bit of creativity and forethought you put into that. I mean, that is a little something extra. That, well done.
Yeah, thank you. He's terrific. So it's great. It's great having him as a reader. He's been there from minute one. And yeah, I've been loving writing the series. It's definitely been, I feel like in some ways, Orphan X was my 16th novel. And I feel like this series has been the culmination of my career. I mean, I got the 9th one coming out in February called Lone Wolf. But it's been an amazing experience. And I'm always glad talking to people who are the real deal like you two who find it working. I have a lot of spec ops friends. So I get my facts and gun stuff checked pretty tight. So I don't want to make a mistake. There's two things you can't do in a thriller. You can't make a gun mistake and you can't kill a cat. Like those are the two things that'll end your career, you know? So I'm trying to cover both bases.
Never kill a cat. There's a whole Netflix series on that.
That's right.
Oh my gosh. Now, when you bring up the guns, like the detail of the Wilson Combat, because that's one of my favorite manufacturers, and I'm a big sports competitive shooter type. Not that I'm any good, but I just love the Wilson Combat. But you're getting into it, the intricacies of it, the details of the Orphan X universe down to like, you know, the living arrangements, the way he thinks, the people he talks to, the conversations. You could tell your background with everything you've written is kind of built into these universes. Cause like, you know, coming from the comic books, and coming from the other types of stuff you've written, there's like a whole universe inside your mind of the Orphan X. I can imagine you mapping it out.
It's a lot of fun. And I rely on a lot of subject matter experts who make me seem brighter than I am. You know, I talk to hackers. I have great, great people on the gun and weaponry front. I've shot all the weapons he's on. You know, I had a good buddy who passed away, Billy Stojak, who helped me a lot with Tommy Stojak. I borrowed his last name because last names of guys in special operations community, military community, and baseball are like the best last names, right? So they're just unimprovably named. I mean, I remember like Buster Posey was my favorite player for the Giants for a long time. You name your kid Buster Posey, you pretty much seal his vocational fate. And so Stojak was amazing, but I'd go out there and he'd be like, you know, everything would be like, you want to go throw some big boy lawn darts out in the desert? He lived out in Vegas, and I would go get on everything and he'd walk me through it. So And it's similar with, you know, I have kind of world-class hackers who do the other scenes that involve that. And what's good is that I'm not an expert. I'm not an expert with guns. And so the engagement I have with people who are, you know, extraordinarily knowledgeable, the translation for me to understand it sort of helps me bring that and then describe it to average readers. Cause I don't want to be just writing like gun porn, you know. You want to be writing stuff where, you know, real experts and operators like you guys can read it and I'm not tripping over myself, but also people can read it from all sorts of different backgrounds. And so part of that is to try and make everything about character also, like the weapons he chooses, the way he outfits his rig's a Ford F-150. He's got it sort of insulated, but everything should be a reflection of character. The vodkas that he drinks some of the world's greatest vodkas. I get a lot of those sent to me here.
Okay. I do like that though. Like, cause listening to the audible and you're talking about the vodka and the girl gets in the car and she's like, what do you want? Like sky or you want something? And he's like, it's like the inadequacies of him. You know, so you're having someone who's fallible. So he's like, you know, yeah, he could be like the best killer in the world, but his social skills are a little bit like very introverted.
Stunted.
Stunted is a good word.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a key line for me that I say in each book around which the whole series coalesces. And when he's taken out of this foster home, when he's 12 years old, his handler and father figure, Jack John, says to him, the hard part isn't turning you into a killer. The hard part is keeping you human. And it's like, that's the skill set he doesn't really have because he's just trained to be this operate, this assassin, this machine. But the series is really about his, I say he never learned to speak the strange language of intimacy. He doesn't understand these interactions, but the series is really about his process of becoming three-dimensionalized. It's almost like, you know, when Orphan X opens, it's like he's Pinocchio, but he wants to be a real boy. He just has no idea how to go about it. And so he's got this, like, he can, you know, calculate the wind drift on a sniper round from 1,000 meters, but he's completely undone when it comes to talking to, you know, the annoying elderly Jewish woman who lives upstairs from him at the mail slots, who may or may not be based on my deceased grandmother. So, but, you know, so that's the thing that I thought about with this, which is these archetypal characters who we love, like Reacher and Bourne and Bond, we don't get to see them go home. We don't get to see them have an awkward encounter with a single mom in the elevator, right? Like, so there's these moments for me where he's moving between this space that is almost a mythological space where he's operating and conducting the missions, but then crashing into a reality that he's not quite certain how to contend with, and his skills don't necessarily translate, and he's trying to learn how to translate them across through the course of the series and become a human.
There is something incredibly satisfying about having a character like Evan Smoke, who is so incredibly fine-tuned in some regards, but then see him struggle with just having to be forced into like the homeowners association meeting, you know, the having, you know, him panic because he sees, you know, a child's handprint on his refrigerator. I mean, those made him human to me, but at the end of the day, he really is truly, he's a protector. I mean, he was trained to be a killer, but he chooses to use that skill set to help those who can't help themselves.
That's right. I mean, and that's really the underpinning is once he left the program, I mean, part of it is that ethic that Jack instilled in him to be a perfect assassin. He lives his life by the 10 assassin's commandments, but to also remain human, that's like two trains on a collision course. And so at a certain point, his own moral compass is just becomes unhinged from the missions he's asked to do. And so when he leaves, what he does after that is he only will embark on missions that are aligned with his moral compass. And these missions, which are the Nowhere Man missions, it's another one of his aliases when he operated, are when that phone rings and there's somebody who's in a desperate position. And him undertaking these missions to, it's basically trying to restore for people the kinds of ordinary lives he can never have for himself. Like he knows that he can't have that, but when he sees families or individuals being terrorized at the hands of other humans, he knows that he can intervene and sort of set their life right again. And it's almost like reclaiming his soul one mission at a time, one tiny mosaic piece at a time, from some of the assassinations that he conducted.
I say I came to this series late, as Jason did as well. And, you know, I kick myself for waiting so long to pick up Orphan X. But at the same time, I feel pretty fortunate now that I know I've got 8 more of these to go. So I don't have to sit around and wait a year for another book to come out. So I'm feeling pretty good about that. But did you foresee writing? Yep. What, book number 9 now?
Yeah, you know, I did. It was really interesting. I think I wrote a lot of standalones also. I wrote like Hitchcock standalones. I had one series of 4 books early in my career, but I very much was a standalone writer. And I think that part of what it was for me was waiting until I had a character. You know, I spend more waking hours with Evan Smoke than I do with my wife and kids, right? I mean, like I'm with him all the time. And I had to find a character that felt like I'm constantly learning. And as he learns, I'm learning. And as I'm learning, I'm putting it in the plots. And this kind of evolution of him, he's sort of thawing out of these 10 commandments that are a more black and white way of viewing the world into a view that is more complicated. He has to start to learn and engage with the messiness of human life, the messiness of intimacy. And he's OCD. He's got like strong OCD. And so this sort of engagement of real people with all their complications and all their messes and all their confusions and all the things that put you in a different place are really a lot of the process that he's learning. And I thought it was something that I could move and grow with for a series that I don't see an end in sight. But I didn't imagine, like right now I'm working on the next one. I'm more engaged than I've been in my whole career. Like every book that I'm writing, I'm more excited about. And to be this deep into a series and to have set it up in a way where his character is the thing. Look, at the end of the day, all we care about is character. You know, if you stop someone on the street and ask them their favorite James Bond action sequence, they'll pause a minute, but we all know how he takes his martini, you know? And so if I have this engagement with Evan and then these other characters that are starting to come in and building out his world, you know, which starts happening in the later books and the Nowhere Man and Hellbent, and it sort of increases his three-dimensionalizing. That's amazing. And then I get to go off and explore whatever topics are of interest to me too, and do these deep dives in different areas.
I love nonstop action, but I don't, you know, that's the thing is like when you bring up character and you bring up the thrillers, like all everything to me needs to be built around a story now. Like it's tough for me to watch, like, I'll turn on a Netflix movie and if it's just action, I'm like, you know what? I'm looking at it and I'm like, well, it's just shoot them up, shoot them up, shoot them up. And you're just like, oh gosh, there's no story. You don't feel anything for the characters. But once you start getting vested in these characters, you're like, oh, I can't wait. It's like when we were kids and you're waiting for the comic books every month because you're like, you're left at a cliffhanger all the time.
That's right.
You can't wait for that month. And now it's with these books. And that's why one thing Amos said was like, we do have 8 books ahead of us. So now I'm like me, like whether I'm working out or whether I'm driving long distance or whether I'm doing anything, I'm always listening to an audible. So now I'm like, okay, now I don't have to keep looking for, hey, what's Ray Porter narrating this month? I'm like, you know, what's Scott Pilgrim doing? So now I'm like, I'm vested on this journey because of the character. Now I've picked up books, a lot of books too. You know, we talk about action movies and books and stuff. And all it is just like an advertisement for a gear, or it's just this nonstop action. You're like, well, where's the substance? I want to learn something. Like even in this book, even fiction books, I'm always learning something or looking at things in a different way. So that's what I like about these universes, because I could look at them and go, huh, that's a different way to look at that, because there's humanity behind it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Em.
I was going to say, I don't know. I learned something. I learned how fragile shoulder joint is, apparently. And that stuck with me. So, you know, even the action sequences can teach you something.
Well, everything's got to go back to character. I mean, one of the things I think about all the time is how is an Orphan X action sequence different from Reacher, right? Different than Swagger. It's different than, because everything's got to have its own aspect that speaks back to character. Because that's, again, that's what we love the most. And so the vodka he has, the gear that he uses, the truck that he drives, the dialogue that he has, the engagement, every action sequence, it has to be something that revolves around and feels like it's unique to him. Or else, as Jason was saying, It's like being in those movies that you're just sitting there feeling like you're getting punched in the face with action, and you don't care, because even in an action sequence, even in a fight, character has to come through, or else anyone can choreograph it.
Oh, and that's fair. And, you know, character probably plays more of a role for you because you've had, well, extensive amount of experience in other mediums. So with comics, comics are all about character. And then you've written for screenplays, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can't put anything on the screen that you can't show. So, you know, if you don't have that investment, if you don't sympathize or empathize with the character, then nobody watches your movie.
Yeah, that's right. And it just, you know, it just becomes more of the same. And so, you know, that's been really the process for me, is watching Evan grow. And you'll see, I mean, I remember when I first pitched the series to my agent, I said, look, there's this phone number and it rings and he answers the same way every time. He says, do you need my help? And somebody tells them where they are and he goes to help them. And I said, at some point, for instance, and he's an orphan, like I said, he was left. He didn't know either of his parents. He was, you know, the smallest kid in a foster home, but a kid with the most grit. I always think of that Floyd Patterson quote, the boxer, where he holds the record for having the most knockdowns in a fight. It was 16. And he said, I also hold the record for the most times getting up. And so that's Evan. Evan was the smallest kid, and he's completely ordinary. Like, unlike Bond, who's devastatingly handsome or charming, or Reacher's a huge guy. I mean, Evan, I say in every book, he's just an average guy, not too handsome. You know, ordinary size, ordinary build. And so it's really been about, you know, him coming into the world and sort of growing up and having been shaped in a certain way, and then seeing all the places where that works for him and doesn't work, and this kind of learning process of him to move out beyond that. Because there's a tension between perfection and intimacy. You know, I played with this a bit. Novels have always been my first love. I mean, you know, so comics were later, TV and features were later. But when I was writing on Batman, I wrote Batman for a couple of years. I was very interested in this theme because why I like Batman so much is he's everything that he represents is the pinnacle of human achievement. He doesn't have a magic ring like Green Lantern. He can't fly like Superman. He doesn't have adamantium claws like Wolverine. He's just discipline and technology. But part of how he maintains that is there's no intimacy in his life, right? His parents died when he was young. He's a perennial bachelor / playboy. Robin's always getting killed. Then there's a new Robin. Then the new Robin gets killed. Like, he's constantly alone. And so it's this interesting thing where in some ways you can have perfection if there's no other humans around messing up your life with emotions and feelings and their schedules and their needs and their wants. And we all know this as parents, you know, we all know this as spouses. People are complicated, and then we discover how complicated we are. Right. And so in a vacuum, he can have sort of perfection, but the more that he starts to thaw into being a human, the more these complications start to eat in at him, and he starts to feel vulnerability, and he starts to have troublesome emotion come in, which starts to undercut the fourth commandment. His fourth assassin's commandment is never make it personal. And so, you know, the second one is how you do anything is how you do everything. And that's, in some ways, is the most famous. Like, there's soldiers have gotten that tattooed. People have had jewelry made with that. I mean, it's this rigor. But it gets very complicated when there's humans involved and you care about them. And so he's got to figure out, is that something that he wants around, since he doesn't really understand how to do that effectively.
Welcome to the world of the Punisher. It's like, whenever you get that human interaction is when everything starts going wrong. But about the Orphan X is, you know, true crime. I love true crime. I love, like, just coming from my background, Emma's background with Intel and human and everything. But I love forensics. I love forensics. And I'm thinking, the more human interaction he has, the more cross-transference of, like, fibers and, you know, the blood stains and everything else. I just, in my mind, I see him going, oh, geez, I got to clean that up. I got to clean this up. I got to, like, do this so there's no trace of me anywhere. Because his whole life is about being, you can't find him. You can't find him anywhere. He backtraces everything. He backtracks everything. He does his surveillance. He's one step ahead because he plans and plans and plans. But when you add, like, a little kid in there, you add human interaction, it really screws up the whole plan.
That's right. And he keeps getting dragged into these annoying HOA meetings, you know, so he'll be like bleeding out through his sleeve and trying to get home and covering up a knife wound, and he'll get stuck in an HOA meeting and they're having a heated debate over the, you know, the carpet pile for the lobby or something inane that he's just desperately trying to get out of. And so, you know, I feel like there's a metaphor for that in all of our lives, because, you know, no matter how great we are at one thing or one skill set, there's always areas that we feel like imposters, or we feel like we're, you know, no one has intimacy perfectly nailed, right? That's just not, it's not an arena that you can reach perfection with. And so I think there's a lot of people really relate to those scenes. It's very interesting what people point out in fan mails and in events. It's almost always those little human moments, right? The moments where he's awkward or where he's uncomfortable. It's such a big part of readers' engagement with this, because I think that's what really speaks to us, is this notion that in some ways, somewhere, we feel like an imposter who's not fitting in certain circumstances. And everybody's got that, you know, it just depends which lane it is.
Say, I would completely concur with that. I think it also humanizes him. It's, you know, as nice as it is to have that hero type character that is completely infallible, it's not realistic and it can only carry you so far. So for you to make a lasting character that people are actually going to buy into, making him human in the most human ways is, you know, definitely going to give him longevity.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, I earlier in my career, I thought in some ways of writing about heroes and villains, and the further along I get, I just think of protagonists and antagonists. And as the books progress, what I hope is that the antagonists are sort of whispering a siren song in the ear of the reader or the listener, that what they say makes a lot of sense, but it's just maybe tweaked 15%. And so then if you look at Evan and his engagement is right, I mean, what we connect to so much sometimes are when characters have flaws or shortcomings. You know, if he acts in a way and then is embarrassed, or he's ashamed of it, or he regrets something that he did because he didn't quite figure out how to get the engagement in the way that made sense for him. And so he's far from perfect. And the people who he's up against increasingly are far from, you know, mustache twirling villains. And so what I'm hoping is I'm bringing together this sort of clash of, you know, it's 50 Shades of Grey, just without the S&M.
that's one way to look at it. Yeah.
I want everyone a little bit confused at different times about, you know, is he going to navigate something that's more complicated ethically or emotionally than we thought initially, that there's complications. It's not just sheer good up against sheer evil. Because that's not fun, and it's not as real, and I don't find it as engaging. And the writers who I admire the most, like Megan Abbott and Dennis Lehane, are always painting with a very delicate brush.
You know, that's one question I had for you. You know, and this is where it's me. Hey, I'm gonna be greedy, because I'm trying to jump into the fiction world, because nonfiction for me is easier to write, because I see things. I believe in facts. It's not good for me to have my own personal opinion, because if I'm not an expert on it, who cares about my opinion? The thing is, when you're jumping into the fiction world, is like, it's a whole universe. You could write the wrongs. You could write about the antagonist, the protagonist. Are you mapping out these books as you're going? That's a couple of questions I've always had for authors, is like, some of them like the outline, the whole thing. Okay, I know I'm going to go from point A to B to C to D to E, and I'm eventually going to get to F or Z. Are you mapping these out, or you just kind of have an idea and you're rolling with it?
So I've settled in, you know, that's an age-old question, Jason. Mm-hmm. So this is what everyone asks about. I've done both versions. My first two books I just wrote as I went. I was a kid. I mean, I started my first book, I was 19 years old. And both of them, I delivered these sort of, you know, spectacularly mediocre rough drafts. And I then had to take everything apart like an engine block and rebuild it. Because the only way you can learn to write a novel, and AIM can offer support for this, is when you're writing your first draft and screwing it up of your first novel, it's the only way you can learn. And so, and then at some point I started to outline more and more. And what I realized is if it's too outlined, I don't have the same openness to opportunity and play as I'm writing. And so I do something that's quite unusual. I call it a rolling outline. And so I'm talking to you guys now. I have a flat screen TV as my monitor and I have two documents side by side. And I'll start off with usually 16 to 20 pages of just bullet points, roughly shaped into groups, snippets of plots, or chapter ideas, character stuff, snatches of dialogue, themes, and they're roughly shaped up. And I tend to know the first three, four chapters. I tend to know the kind of opening flourish of a book. And then as I write, I'm starting to write over here in the manuscript. The outline first swells as I'm writing the book. I mean, right now it's still, I'm in the middle of a manuscript right now, and it's still like, it'll swell and then I'll write it down and then I have more ideas. But as I'm writing in the book, all of a sudden I'll think, oh wait, here's this great place. I can drop a handkerchief in the first act and refer to it in the second act and pay it off in the third act. And so the outline is kind of rolling and changing and evolving and getting more specific. And at some point it stops bloating and it starts to shrink. And at the end, this document is a 450 page manuscript, and then the outline is just empty because it's all been eaten by the manuscript. So it's a living and breathing thing all the way through.
I like that a lot, and I'm going to confess now, I might actually steal that and, you know, try to use that in my next go round. That is a fantastic idea.
Well, because we don't want to get too rigidly locked into an outline, because think how much we discover when we're writing. You know, I have characters sometimes where I all of a sudden I'll start to get their voice in the third, fourth chapter. And it's like, I don't want to have it my high resolution brainstorming notion before it started. So I think in a lot of ways that a writer's job more than almost anything is to be open to opportunity.
Completely. Yes.
And that goes along with him when he operates, right? Like, he's got to see everything. And you guys, I mean, you know this better than I do because you're both the real deal. But, you know, when you're operating, you have to see everything as if for the first time. It's like Zen's beginner mind. Like, is a deadbolt 2 millimeters off course? Like, you can't move forward with rote, right? Like, a lot of us, like, I mean, I'll drive home sometimes from the gym or something, and I won't even remember being in the car. Like, we get on autopilot. And so when you're in a field like Evan, or when you guys are operating, as opposed to when, you know, you're running around parenting and slurping coffee, it's a very different skill set of the amount of sort of attention and focus that you need. You know, for me, that's if I'm doing a sport or if I'm writing, it's like this heightened state. And so Evan's trained in that. And obviously you can see where that tips into hypervigilance, right? Or it can tip into OCD, or it can, or some PTSD can come in and stoke it at different times where it's an unending state of hypervigilance. And so it's really writing about that constant focus. But part of what that is constantly being open to anything that is an opportunity that might change, that might be a threat. And so in a weird way, I think a lot of the process is fractal, where like I'm writing about a character who's doing that, and I'm trying to apply that process to writing about that character to keep everything open and alive so I can be reactive and flexible in the writing as he needs to be as he operates.
I got a big world ahead of me to start building, but it's great to have time now to do it. You know, you have all these thoughts in your mind, and like when you're thinking, I was thinking about like the operating thing, you almost have to have an OCD, because if you don't, you're going to get drained. When you're on hypervigilance all the time, when you're on vigilance, when you're looking around, when you're on the job and you're like, you're always covering your six, you're always looking at what's going on. Does that seem out of place? Does that person seem out of place? And everything in your life is life or death, it gets burned out. So when you get the OCD, you're like, huh, okay. Your mind is always going through the checks. You're always going through the checks. So it could handle it. Because if your mind isn't compartmentalized like that, to be able, okay, check one, check two, check three, then you're going to burn out.
That's right. And you can also understand as that operationalizes, which you guys would know more than me, sometimes when you're check one, check two, check three, it's not the most intimate engagement with the person who you might be with in a personal sense. And so how do you balance that perfection and those needs, right, with also knowing that there's a professional set of standards to maintain, but also you have people you have to care about and let in, you know? And so it's there's these very different modes. And yeah, so he has this OCD that he functions with, but you know, we tend to look at these things as pure negatives or like a pure mental illness. And, you know, one of the lines I use in one of the books that's upcoming is I say, every curse has a blessing. It's not just the reverse, right? So part of his grinding, and it can get revved to high where everything out of place starts to just bother him, especially if there's something emotional that's up, right? The volume will get turned up on it. But it's not like that's something he can just excise and do away with, because a lot of times the holes or gaps that we have are because some other part of us is cantilevered out towards excellence, right? So there's like a negative space. You know, and a lot of people who I've, you know, friends or in my community who are excellent in something, whether it's, you know, snipers or professors or mathematicians or, you know, carpenters, it doesn't matter what the field is, but if you're excellent at something, there tends to be some kind of neuroticism or individuality. I always think that's why military and cops have the best senses of humor, right? Because there's a, you have to have something to keep the insanity in its right place a little bit.
Best or darkest?
Darkest.
Same thing for me when it comes to humor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like, oh my God, like you can joke about that. But it's part of that thing of trying to keep, you know, the sort of craziness that drives excellence on the right side. You know, it's hard to distinguish. It's hard to distinguish.
It's trying to keep your humanity in a way.
That's right. That's right. And having and keeping a brilliance that's applied in one direction, you know, which both you guys in the course of your career, there's got to be a kind of brilliance if you're going to have a 20-year career in something. In all senses of the word. I mean, I don't just mean cerebrally, but I mean, there's a bright shining focus on something. And, you know, there's got to be other things that balance that. There's a cost to that. And then you have to bear the cost gracefully and you have to make fun of it. And so there's all these pieces. And it's another thing I really like in the books is that Evan's kind of surrounded, the people he's interacting with are all better than him at one thing. Like Tommy Stojak's a better shot. Josephine Morales is a better hacker. Melinda Trong's a better counterfeiter. So he can do all these things, but everyone he engages with is better at the one thing than him. And so there's a lot of shit talking, which is really fun for me to write. I didn't want to have a character that everyone sort of is enamored with, you know, but it also helps because then when he does something that seems unlikely, it seems to make sense because he's doing it the one thing at a kind of lesser level. But in a lot of ways, he's kind of like Ulysses. He's the man of many wiles. You know, Ulysses isn't as great a fighter as Achilles. He was second or third in every category, but he has to bring the totality of who he is to any situation. And so Evan's sort of that like assimilating center. I mean, that's part of why I say, you know, he's average size, average build, you know, just a normal guy, not too good looking. You'd look right past him. He's got to bring everything around it into play. But what's fun for me is when he comes to those experts, they're like, you know, frustrated with his inability to grasp, you know, some higher order aspect of, you know, network intrusion, even though he's pretty damn good at it, you know, better than you or I.
You know, you mentioned a couple times about Ama and I. Listen, we've been around some really good people. We've been around the real operators and stuff like that. But I think everybody, like you said, everybody has an expertise. And like in law enforcement, we would have a group of 10 people, you know, in our squad or our group. And every one of them had some lazy people. But even those lazy people, they were really good at one thing. That's right. They might be really good at paperwork. You're like, hey, you know what? You're gonna tag the evidence. You're going to do this. You're going to do that. Two people are really good at kicking doors and clearing places.
Yeah.
Everybody has like an expertise.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of cool. Like in the real world, everybody's the same. It's just that we just at one point in our lives, we just went down a different path and we became an expert on something. Like you're an expert author, you're an expert narrator when it comes to like the prose. And it's like you just become an expert at your realm. And I like the fact that you're reaching out to other experts. The best authors we've seen are the ones who reach out to the experts. The authors who think they know it all.
Yeah.
I don't think we know who they are because they never really go any far. They don't go that far.
Yeah. It's funny. You talk about door kicking. I remember I did when I was writing about the Marshals, I wrote some books that dealt with the Marshal Service. It's always funny where there's like the one guy who's great with the battering ram, right? And there might be another guy who's like super badass number one through the door, but if he does the battering ram, it like sails through his arms through the door panel because he misses the lock assembly. And it's like, oh, you know.
But that's the truth. That's the reality. Yeah. It's, I love it.
Everyone needs their lane. And so, but you're right in a way, you know, a lot of what I think about is, to me, there's sort of a dividing line between people who are good people, right? Like there's the people, you know, you can rely on. There's the people, you know, who are going to be, are going to have your back. There's people, you know, you can trust. There's, you know, and there's all these different levels of expertise in every field. In every field, if somebody loves what it is that they do and they go all the way down in that, every field can contain the wisdom from everything. You know, it's not like if you're a Harvard professor of archaeology that somehow that's either that you're more moral or wise than if you're sort of an expert plumber who's pursuing exactly how a system works within a house and has all the tools and expertise to do it. And more I find, you know, craftsmen, workers of any type. I have a very good friend who's a Christian Orthodox icon carver, which is like the weirdest field imaginable. And the expertise he brings to that and the symbology that he brings in that sort of cracks open into the wisdom of everything. And so, you know, I'd rather take somebody who's devoted and focused and excellent in one arena. You can talk about anything with that, right? Versus finding somebody who's kind of mediocre in some field that we might think of as being, you know, higher in its intellectual capabilities. Let's say it doesn't matter if it's rote, there's nothing there. And if somebody's focused, no matter who they are, and look, you see this all the times. I mean, I have guys who I've talked to, like, you know, Dwayne Dwyer, who did Strider Knives. He's now a knife guy who's just, you know, he's also like philosophy, and he's an expert in metals, and he's combining stuff like the range and scope. I had a buddy who is one of the biggest demolition breachers in the world, and he'd come down big old tough handlebar mustache. Like, he's so badass. But I'd come up in the middle of the night and he'd be writing down, like calculating overpressure charges. And it's like, I'd look at this butcher paper laid out and he's doing math that like my buddy who's running the physics institute at Santa Barbara, and he have a great conversation, right? When they're talking about how things work, it's connecting all these different areas where people shine, and people are extraordinary if they decide to be.
And if you let them, a lot of times, like when you have these conversations with people and you're like, wow, they know that. Like when you're talking about like the EOD and when you're talking about knives, and there are so many people that are brilliant, and there are so many people. You see a lot of people that come from the special operations forces, from the military, combat veterans, who are so creative.
Yeah.
Like their new outlet is creativity, whether that's art, whether that's writing, whether that's making knives. They are so creative because their mind is always working. It's always solving problems. It's always building universes. I know we've kept you for a little bit. I've got one more question, and Ema's got one more question. My question is this. It's the 1990s. You're in your 20s. From 1990 to 1998, you watch a lot of movies. What is your favorite 1990s movie?
That's hard.
I'm going to give a run. And I think, I don't know the exact year, but this would certainly be in the 90s. There was a run when on consecutive weekends, Shawshank Redemption, The Professional, Quiz Show, and I want to say Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction might have been a little bit later, but there was this run when movies were coming out that were all so exceptional, you couldn't even believe it. I don't know if you guys have seen Quiz Show. It's extraordinary.
Oh, yeah. Robert,
I mean, it's, but there was just this run that you couldn't even believe it. Like, and The Usual Suspects, Chris McQuarrie. And it was a stretch. I think Pulp Fiction was a little bit later, if I'm not mistaken, but I mean, and it was just an incredible, incredible stretch, you know. And I've had some fun with my daughter during the pandemic. I have an 18-year-old, and you know, so she was 15, and we did these tranches of movies where I was like The Professional, Hannah, and Man on Fire. Like we did grouping, right? Alien, Aliens, The Thing, and Jaws. and we went through a lot of them. But what would yours now, be,
Jason? Oh, Heat's my all-time favorite.
Heat's great, man.
Heat's and when great. when you talk Man on Fire, I always think the Scott Glenn, Joe Pesci Man on Fire from the 1980s.
Yeah.
But the
the Tony Scott Denzel one.
Oh,
man,
yeah. That movie absolutely.
That makes me cry every time.
That's one of my favorite soundtracks. I love it. I'm a big soundtrack guy.
That movie, Tony Scott, when he was on, was so amazing. It's got a 1 hour first act. Now, first act of movies is supposed to be 20 minutes to 25, maybe 30. It's a full hour that's just the relationship between Creasy and the girl. And so we were talking about character. I mean, you're just all in on this, so that it's like drawing back a bow, right? And then when it turns, you're just completely in emotionally. Aim, you're on mute, but yeah.
Oh, no. I think for me, the movies that from the 90s that stuck with me the most, Clerks, Natural Born Killers, and The Matrix.
Wow. And Natural Born Killers, you know who wrote that?
Oliver Stone did it. Yeah,
wild, huh?
I love Oliver Stone.
True Romance was great too.
Yeah.
And I think, didn't Tarantino write the script for that? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, no, what an era. Clerks, man, the early Kevin Smith. He's terrific. He's, speaking of comics too, that guy knows more about comics. He's forgotten more about comics than we know, and I've written a lot of the damn things. Yeah, there's a lot of talent. And I loved early Spike Lee stuff. I loved She's Gotta Have It. I loved She's Gotta Have It. I loved the Denzel, Mo Better Blues.
Mm-hmm.
Was great. Spike Lee was ascendant. He was so
good. Well, the 90s were all when the original indie movies came out. Before That's right. Indies were like, you know, $1 million movies. Back then it was like, you know, El Mariachi, you know.
That's right.
Like the Robert Rodriguez, everything was like real indie movies. So and that's why I love the 90s when it comes to
movies. Yeah, and watching Do the Right Thing was like, mm-hmm. Who is this guy? I went back and watched School Days and
Dan Aiello. Everything. Yeah.
All that. Yeah. That's cool.
It's like our trip down memory lane. We're showing our age. You realize that.
I know. I'm 50 years old. So I'm right in that wheelhouse of the 90s.
I got less than a month left before I hit 51.
You got this. It's a good
thing. Okay, Ema, last question.
Last question. This one is, you know, kind of a inquiring minds want to know, you know, as you know, you do so much with ITW, is there any chance that Thriller Fest will ever kind of bounce around like the other conventions, or is it always going to stay in New York?
Well, part of why, I mean, for the foreseeable future, we're in New York, and part of why, so ITW is International Thriller Writers, bit of backdrop for some of the listeners who might not know it. And I've had the pleasure of being the president I'm in my second term. I'm co-president first with Heather Graham, who's wonderful, and now with Lisa Unger. And it's great. I mean, we've had George R. R. Martin. We had Walter Mosley last year. But we keep it in New York because it's a bit trade industry focus, meaning we bring a lot of agents in. We do. There's a lot of concrete ways that we try to help. Like I'll usually sit down every year. I did it last year with Lisa Gardner, who's, I don't know if you've had her on, but she's terrific. And we talked to all the first year published authors. Everyone turned their phones off and we're like, ask anything. It was like 30 of us in a room or 15 of us in a room about. And so we try to bring a lot of agents, publishing expertise, and a lot of stuff. So New York's just where so much of the industry is focused that we try to have that. And in a way, we do have a lot of fans and readers, but it's a bit more industry focused. So I think that we're going to be sticking in New York, at least for the foreseeable future. But I hope you guys will come. Jason, you said you might come this year.
Oh, yeah. I'm only, it depends. Are we talking about the turnpike or am I taking the train? If I'm taking the turnpike or 95, it'd be 6 hours. Oh my gosh. But I just took the train into New York a couple weeks ago and it's a super easy trip. I'm there. Am, are you coming?
I can't recommend Thriller Fest enough. I won't be able to make it this year, but I will be back just because it is always a blast every time I go. I love it.
Greg, I appreciate you coming on the show. And I've got a lot of catching up to do. A lot of listening. Jeff and I are going to be like best friends by the time I'm done with this series.
Well, it's terrific talking to you both. Thank you for having me on.